Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
I think we're up to 27, right? Vratar mama sutakachin.
Vratar mama sutakachin.
Matra sahabhavad vraji. Tatam bhavantam manvano. Bhavad bhyam ubalalitah. Vratar mama sutakachin. Matra sahabhavad vraji. Tatam bhavantam manvano. Bhavad bhyam upalalitah. Mama, my Sutaha, son, Baladev, born of Rohini, Kachit, weather, Matra Saha, with his mother Rohini, Bhavat Raji, in your house. Tatam, as father. Bhavantam, unto you. Manvanaha, thinking. Bhavadbhyam, by you and your wife, Yashoda. Upalalitaha, properly being raised. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. My dear Baladev, being raised by you and your wife, Yashoda Devi, considers, my son Baladev, being raised by you and your wife, Yashoda Devi, considers you his father and mother. Is he living very peacefully in your home with his real mother, Rohini? There's no purport, so I'll read the next verse with a short purport. Pungsas trivargo vihita surido yanubhavita nate shuklishyamaneshu trivargo tayakalpate. When one's friends and relatives are properly situated, one's religion, economic development, and sense gratification, as described in the Vedic literature, are beneficial. Otherwise, if one's friends and relatives are in distress, these three cannot offer any happiness. Purport. Vasudeva regretfully informed Nanda Maharaja that although he had his wife and children, he could not properly discharge his duty of maintaining them and was therefore unhappy. We have to try to understand something of the logic of pastimes, lila, the logic of rasa, otherwise we will misunderstand completely what is going on here. If we were impersonalists, we would argue, if you're really foolish impersonalists, clever impersonalists know how to pretend to be Vaishnavas. You know, so they know all the technical rules of what rasa is and how personal spiritual life is conducted They know the superficial externalities of it. So beware of Mayavadis in Vaishnav clothing. But a foolish Mayavadi who doesn't even know how to pretend to be a Vaishnava would argue that Vasudev is an illusion. He's attached to his family. He's attached to Grihastha. And he's in anxiety over the situation of his, not only his own wife and children, but somebody else's wife and children also. Extremely attached. And therefore extremely an illusion. And therefore he's suffering. And if he could only attain an equal poised consciousness in Brahman realization, he would be happy. This is what a foolish impersonalist might think. Yes, Nanda Maharaj is a Grihastha. He's got his family attachments, and these family attachments are causing him great distress, apparently. Remember, as we were reading this morning, that Kamsa killed his first seven children. Six sons. That's a cause for distress. To be oppressed like that, it's a kind of test that none of us probably could pass and still remain Krishna conscious. But Nanda Maharaj passed the test with flying colors and remained totally dedicated to the pleasure of Krishna and to his protection, and totally confident of his protection, of Krishna protecting him. Despite this happening, Krishna does this to his devotees. Not maybe in the case of a neophyte devotee, he has to be given a hard time in order to purify him. But this is not, again, maybe we're not impersonalists, but we're neophytes, and we think that all devotees are like us. All devotees are an illusion, have 1 foot in the material mud and 1 foot in transcendence. And we have to be taught a lesson by Maya working for Krishna. But we would be very foolish also to judge Nanda Maharaj that way. That he's, Vasudev. That Vasudev had to be taught a lesson. He had to be, have his six sons wrenched away from him in order to teach him renunciation. Vasudev didn't need to learn renunciation. Vasudev is already perfectly adept in the highest, surrender to Krishna. Krishna has agreed to become his son. He's already become his son in two previous lives. He's not a neophyte. He doesn't need to be purified. But the rasa needs to be properly developed. And that means the stimulation of these different ecstasies add up to the natural development, the evolution of the rasa, of the ecstasy. The ecstasy of being Krishna's parent, of losing his association for the duration of his childhood, and then getting him back. Although there's suffering, apparent suffering, in the story of Krishna's pastimes, but there's always a happy ending. Madhurina samapayet, proper completion of the story, of the drama, is always with something sweet. One argument is given that the hero cannot be given, the poetic experts, the Alankara Shastris, they explain that the story has to resolve with a happy ending. One thing you cannot do is kill the hero before the end. The whole story evolves around the hero. So it's against the rules of poetic construction to create or dramatic construction to make a plot where the hero's killed. Not in Sanskrit drama. You're not allowed to do that. So you can assume the hero's going to survive. He may go through a lot of trouble, but he's going to win in the end, and he's not going to get killed. In the transcendental drama of these leelas, on the realm of real rasa, not mundane, perverted rasa, Krishna is the hero. In some cases, there may be a story involving Krishna's devotee as the hero. But generally, Krishna himself is the cynosure of all eyes. He's the Nayaka, or the hero of all the stories, basically. So there's no question that the story is going to come to a point where Krishna is going to get killed. He can't. Kamsa cannot kill the hero. That would be against the rules of drama. And the devotees involved are all confident of that. That Krishna will be victorious. That Krishna's devotees will be victorious. Vasudeva and Devaki will enjoy eternal happiness in the association of Krishna, despite all these horrible things that seem to be happening to them. So a neophyte devotee has to have horrible things to happen to him because he's so foolish and has to be forcibly wrenched away from his illusion by making him suffer. But an advanced pure devotee only goes through apparent suffering. And that the purpose of that apparent suffering is to stimulate the full-blown combination of all the bhavas that make the rasa, the transcendental enjoyment. It's to stimulate the enjoyment that the apparent suffering is undergone. And it's not only in this one case. This is not an aberration that Vasudeva and Devaki suffered the loss of their son. When Krishna went to Dwarka, he got married. Krishna remained a bachelor, although he left his girlfriends when he went to Mathura. He remained there for 33 years as a bachelor. Some speculate that Kubja was his wife, his common-law wife, but that's just wild speculation. Actually, Krishna didn't get married his first until he went to Dwarka. And Rukmini was his first wife. She is none different than Chandravali, the second of all the gopis. And she gets to be first in Dwarka, the first queen and the most prominent queen, the most surrendered queen of Krishna, always tolerating everything. Right wing, not left wing, not getting angry, chastising Krishna, but always accepting everything that Krishna does submissively. That's the mood of Rukmini. But look what she went through also by the arrangement of Yogamaya with Krishna's sanction. Pradyumna was born, the first son of Krishna. Incarnation of God. The third of the Chaturvyuha, who was not manifest previously. The two, Vasudeva and Sankarsana, are Krishna and Balaram themselves. And they show themselves as such, especially when they leave Vrindavan. But even in Vrindavan, Krishna and Balaram as Vasudeva and Sankarsana are killing all the demons sent by Kamsa. And then they appear, because they're within the body of Krishna and Balaram in Vrindavan. When they step outside of Vrindavan, then Krishna appears as Vasudeva and Balaram is Sankarsana. And it is Vasudeva and Sankarsana who take up residence in Mathura. And the other two of the Chaturvyuha, Pradyumna and Aniruddha, they appear outside of Krishna and Balaram's bodies only with the birth of Pradyumna. And then Aniruddha, the son of the son, first grandson of Krishna. But look what happened. Read the story. When the boy was only 10 years old, he was kidnapped by the demon Shambhara. And you may say, well, that's the pastime. You know, we read about it in Krishna book. But look at it from Rukmini's point of view. It's not just another adventure. She lost her son when he was 10 days old. And she didn't know if he was still alive. She didn't find out whether he was still alive until he was fully grown and appeared in the household of Banasura. Made an appearance. No, that was Aniruddha. I'm sorry. Anyway, he came back only after he grew up, Pradyumna. So for 20 years or more, Rukmini thought that her first son was dead, or likely dead. Again, devotee put into apparent very deep suffering. not even knowing if he's dead or not. That's more anxiety. If she knew he was dead, then she could lament and get it over with. But she didn't even know whether he was alive or not. A mother who's in that condition, that's the most anxiety-provoking situation. And she lived in that situation for 20 years or more. So Krishna arranged through Yogamaya to put Rukmini, his most beloved queen, through that. Again, apparent suffering. Rukmini is the supreme goddess of fortune, superior to the goddesses of fortune of Vaikuntha. It's not that she needs to be taught a lesson or needs to be punished for anything. This is the workings of Krishna's internal energy. There's apparent suffering. Our perfection is when we will take our suffering and by the alchemy of devoting yourself to Krishna, your suffering will become only apparent. What is it? Mama, was it? Vishaya Vasana Mor Kobe Tucho Hobe Tobe Heruba, is it? No. What's the second half of that couplet? When my hankering for sense gratification becomes insignificant, tucha hobi. Yes. No. Yes. Tobe hama heruba Sri Vrindavan. Then I will be able to actually see Sri Vrindavan. We see something in front of us, but we don't actually perceive the transcendental nature of Sri Vrindavan. We have material vision, even though we're right here in the midst of it, we don't see it properly. We will be able to see Sri Vrindavan for what it is when we give up our hankering, or when our hankering for sense gratification becomes very small, practically of no real force. When we don't experience material pleasure and pain, when we transcend them. Brahma-bhuta prasanatma. First you become equipoised, beyond material hankering, material suffering and pleasure. Then you become peaceful within, satisfied and peaceful. Na shochati na kamshati. No longer lamenting for apparent suffering. You just don't take the pain seriously. You don't lament. Nor do you hanker for some material amelioration of your suffering or material pleasure to counteract it. You don't need it. You don't need sense gratification because you're satisfied. Samak sarveshu bhuteshu. And because you're satisfied within yourself, you don't have to consider anybody your rival or enemy or your friend. Material life means we're dissatisfied, we're unhappy, frustrated. Therefore, we have to do something about it, and we have to use other people and not let them use us in order to ameliorate our suffering. We need to find friends who will make us happy, give us sense gratification in various forms, be it sex or prestige or money or help in achieving our plans. We need partners in our pursuit of sense gratification. And we need to exploit these partners in order to overcome our suffering by replacing it with material success and enjoyment. And there are others who, in the pursuit of their happiness, want to do harm to us in material life. And we have to fight them off. So we're hankering and lamenting in material life, friends and enemies. We're perceiving others mostly as friends and enemies. Those who help our sense gratification and those who are trying to hinder it. That's how we judge everybody. Being disturbed, unhappy, that's how we can't help but judge everybody. But when we become peaceful, when we feel satisfaction within, then samak sarveshu bhuteshu. No more foolishly judging everybody as friend or enemy according to how they serve our purposes of sense gratification or how they hinder it. That is not clear intelligence. That means you're foolish if you're still judging people like that, according to how they help you in your material goals or hinder your material goals. Then he's bad, then he's good. That means you cannot properly judge who is bad and who is good, because your judgment is clouded by that selfishness. A selfish person cannot be intelligent. He may be able to get what he wants. He may have a big bank balance and a nice fancy house, but he's a fool. He can't see reality. He's out of touch with reality because of his selfishness. To attain broad intelligence, the intelligence of a Brahmana, you must become selfless and not judge others as friends and enemies according to how they serve your selfish purposes. You have to have no selfish purposes. Otherwise, you must judge others as friends and enemies. You have to get rid of the selfish purposes. That's the only way to become free of this cycle of illusion and attachment. Samak sarveshu bhuteshu, then mad bhaktim labhate param. Then we can enter the transcendental realm of real spiritual life in the company of Krishna. Satyam jnanam anantam brahma. This is the great declaration that the Mayavadis are fond of, from the Taittiriya Upanishad, Mahavakya. The absolute truth is eternal existence, pure knowledge, unlimited. Satyam jnanam anantam brahma. That is the absolute truth. Yo vedas vihitam guhayam. So shnute sarvakaman saha brahmana vipaschita. This is the continuation of that statement. One who knows that absolute truth, who is hidden within the heart, the super soul, he enjoys a personal relationship with God. So shnute sarva kaman, all his desires are fulfilled because he enters the company, he becomes a companion of the Supreme Lord and joins in his pleasure pastimes. This is Upanishads talking. The same paragraph that the Mayavadis cite as a supposed definition of the formless absolute truth without any qualities. But if you read the rest of the paragraph, it's describing devotional service, pure devotional service, with the formless absolute truth, Satyam Jnanam Anantam. But it describes the loving relationship with Satyam Jnanam Anantam. So Shnute, the devotee, gets all his desires fulfilled because he's in the company of the Supreme Absolute Truth. He becomes the friend of the Absolute Truth and therefore can join in his pleasures. But the requirement is to first of all become Brahma-bhuta, prasanatma. If we're disturbed atma, then we're not going to yet be able to enter the higher realms of devotional service. Vasudeva is prasanatma. He is Brahma-bhuta. He can experience the murder of his first six sons and not be disturbed, not be swayed from his Krishna consciousness. How much can we tolerate without giving up our Krishna consciousness? What's our threshold of tolerance? Not that much. We can be honest with ourselves and look. How close have we ever come to giving up Krishna consciousness? And what was it that made us want to give it up? That we saw someone else fall down? We lost our faith because someone else fell down? Or someone did something to us? Someone abused us in some way while we were trying to practice Krishna consciousness, therefore we almost gave it up? So what is our threshold? Not anything like the threshold of tolerance that Vasudeva has, or Rukmini. But this is the real standard of Krishna consciousness, to be ready to tolerate everything for Krishna's pleasure. And then become established as prasanatma, satisfied within. We have to be taught lessons. because we're still attached. I'll speak for myself. And I'm still attached to material things, material pleasures, material comforts. And therefore, I need to be wrenched away from these attachments. And therefore, I have to suffer. I have to undergo difficulty for purification. But I should tolerate. Tat te nu kom pam. Sus, I should be patient. Enthusiastic, patient, and determined. Utsahan nishayan dairyat. Brahma says, tat te nu kom pam. Susamikshamana bunjina evatmakritam vipakam. A mature devotee, he may still be under the process of purification, and therefore suffering is coming his way to help him become purified. But he tolerates it patiently, expecting, susamikshamana, patiently expecting Krishna's full mercy. When Krishna sees that I'm ready, he will give me his full mercy. I am confident of that. That is the mature attitude. Bunjena evatma kritam. And tolerating, voluntarily suffering the reactions of one's own karma. I am simply suffering the reactions of what I've done in the aparads and sins that I've committed in the past, and maybe still committing. I'm suffering the reactions of those. It's no what I'm experiencing is no one else's fault but mine. And even when I see faults in others, and we have ample opportunity in this Kali Yuga, even in the Association of Devotees, to get samples of faulty personalities. And we can observe and note and talk about the faults of others day and night for the rest of our lives. We can occupy, internet conferences for infinite discussions of everybody else's faults. But we should know that the laws of nature are very subtle. The way that Maya works is very subtle. Everything you see faulty in someone else is actually just bouncing off of you. It's a reflection of what, because you, why are you running into someone else's problem? Why are you affected by someone else's problem? It's because it's your problem. Because it's your fault. It's just reflecting in someone else. There's a psychological principle called projection, where you have a problem, you have a fault, and you see it in other people instead. So that is all pervading in material life. And actually, it's a universal law. Whatever fault you think is, especially when it's a fault that affects you, someone is giving you a hard time, and it's his problem, he's got a problem, he's got some fault in his character, and therefore you're being disturbed. You're suffering. But know that it's because the equivalent fault is in yourself. You get what you deserve. So the mature attitude is to look to the source of the faults in oneself. Atmakritam vipakam. This, whatever I'm suffering, good or bad, is the consequence of my own deeds. What I've done. Blame should not be put on anybody else for what's happening to me. That is mature attitude in devotional service. Then, Jivete yo muktipade sadayabhak. End of that verse says, one who can go on and live out his life in that consciousness of enthusiasm, patience, and tolerance, even if he doesn't yet attain the state of a Paramahamsa, he is guaranteed to, in due course of time, attain that state. He is a worthy inheritor, official, guaranteed. It's in the will has been read, and the father has promised you his fortune. You are the inheritor, but there's terms. Now, when he reaches the age of 25, or leaves the Hare Krishna movement, whichever comes first, he'll get the fortune. The father may put that in the will. So, like that, we're designated heirs to the treasure of Mukti Pade. Of liberation. Not impersonal liberation, but the liberation of one who is Brahma-bhuta prasanatma and attains Krishna's pure devotional service. That liberation is guaranteed us if we come to this stage of maturity. That is the stage of nishtha, firm conviction. from which we cannot be swayed. That's required. Then our success is guaranteed in due course of time. We can't imitate Vasudev or other great devotees who have absolute faith. But we have to become second class, fixed up in the second class platform, so that we won't get knocked down by Maya. We won't be dragged away. We won't give up because we've reached the threshold of our tolerance. Your tolerance becomes adequate to the task when you've reached this stage of nishtha. Then nothing can stop you. Okay, so are there any questions or comments? Yes, have a question. Is the mic there? Yes.
So the impression may be that one first has to get purified, undergoing all the sufferings, like Brahmaputta Prasannatmana Shotakina Kankadengan Parampakti. But in other places, in the Bhagavad Gita, it's all that Parambhishtva Nivartate, so
yes.
In whatever condition you are.
Yes.
So if you have a dream, so like some bestowment of the pure bhakti, so then you automatically will lose all those.
Yes.
So how can we, reconcile our practical condition of serving these 2 points?
Well, whether a devotee has to suffer in order to make real advancement depends on his individual situation. We come to Krishna consciousness. Can you turn it off? Just turn off the key. Oh, I see, because it came apart. Okay. If you can fix it, okay. We come to Krishna consciousness from different material conditionings. Some of us were in the mode, were deeply affected by ignorance. Someone else may be well situated in Sattvaguna. One who begins devotional service from Sattvaguna doesn't have to suffer. He can have an easy time in devotional service, even from the beginning, if you start from Sattvaguna. But there's a rare soul, a real person nowadays, maybe a few people in India, who are living in Sattvaguna before they become devotees. Because in that in the consciousness of mode of goodness, it's like first class intelligence. Prabhupada talks about first, second, and third class intelligence. The man with first class intelligence, which is equivalent to the person in the mode of goodness, you tell him not to do bad, not to do wrong things, because and you warn him that you will be punished by the laws of nature. And the man with first class intelligence listens and obeys. He doesn't do wrong. He doesn't break the laws of nature. That's a man in the mode of goodness, who actually obeys the laws of nature, who doesn't eat meat, doesn't commit violence, doesn't lie, doesn't harm himself by abusing his own body. That's a mode of goodness. And that's a person who hears the advice of Shastra and of Brahmanas, don't do these wrong things. And he doesn't do them. But a man with second-class intelligence, like a man in the mode of passion, has to experience. No, I have to try it. I know I've been warned not to do it, but I have to see what it's like. So he indulges in illicit sense gratification and is punished. Then he learns his lesson and refrains. That's second-class intelligence. And third-class intelligence was the intelligence of a man in the mode of ignorance. Even after being told not to do it, even after doing it, even after being punished, still he continues to do it. So he has to be beaten into submission by Maya. Person who is in the mode of ignorance, who has third-class intelligence, the only conviction can come from argumentum ad baculum, argument from the stick. Like an animal has to be beaten. A cow, you show food, the cow will go for the food. You can't talk to the cow to convince him not to grab the food. You have to hit or threaten with a stick or a broom. Because the cow only understands argumentum ad baculum, argument from the stick. But so a person in the mode of ignorance has to suffer. To become Krishna consciousness, he has to go through a period of heavy suffering. to get overcome his bad conditioning. But a person in the mode of goodness on the other end of the spectrum doesn't have to suffer to enter into Krishna consciousness. He can make easy, painless progress. It depends on our conditioning. Okay? Yeah. It's a reflection of ours.
Yeah, reflection.
We have the equivalent in us.
And when one undergoes this, takes up the preaching, so in preaching work he has to point out to the defects of the people in order to help them.
Yes.
So how should he feel when he does it? So when he,
well, you should feel, therefore a preacher should feel humble, not proud. Oh, I'm pure. And all these karmis are impure and I'm out to save them. Realize that, but for the grace of God, there goes I. That, you know, only because I was saved by my spiritual master, I'm not also walking down this street looking for sense gratification. Only by the grace of my spiritual master have I been saved. I have nothing to my own credit. And then go out and preach. That, you know, that person you're trying to save could have been you last week. Was you before you got saved by your spiritual master. That you're not better, so much better than that person you're trying to save. Then with humility, one can preach effectively. You can preach strongly, but you have to know in your heart that you're not so perfect. If you think you're perfect, then you're asking for trouble. Yes? Okay. Thank you.
You're saying that, like right now, if even though you're in the dham, if you're disturbed by hankering,
especially if you're in the dham,
then you can't see the dham.
Then you can't even stay in the dham if you get too disturbed.
So how can you like get rid of these hankerings or lamentations and have not come to?
We have to be very careful in the dham with our external behavior. That will the mind will be controlled when we control our behavior. We have to be careful not to commit an offense against anybody in the dham. Whoever it is, even people coming from the outside, that they've come here makes them special. And we have to treat everybody with respect. If we avoid really heavy, bad, inexcusable offenses, then the effect of the dharma will work on us and we will become purified just by being here. But the main thing is not to get ourselves kicked out by serious offenses against anybody. If we can just stay here, then everything will work out fine. You know, we will be purified just by the influence of being here. Problem is to not get kicked out. And the main reason for getting kicked out is aparadha. Especially against Vaishnava, you know, against advanced Vaishnavas, but even against neophytes. Even against the residents who don't seem to be practicing anything. Still, they're very dear to Krishna, and we have to be careful in our dealings with them. Even in our thoughts about them. You know, we have to avoid not getting hateful against anybody in the dham. That we won't be able to stay if we feel hatred against anybody here. Okay, I agree with you. Yes? No, but they're not experiencing suffering. It's apparent suffering. It's only apparent, external appearance of suffering that pure devotees have to undergo. How can a pure devotee be made to actually be unhappy? Krishna will not do that to his pure devotees. Pandavas are great heroes. They're meant to be able to undergo tribulations. That's the test of a kshatriya. Now, what's the use of being a kshatriya if you have an easy life? Then, you know, you won't be glorious. Kshatriya has to undergo difficulty to be glorious. Pandavas are the most glorious kshatriyas, because they tolerated and overcame so many difficulties. If there weren't any difficulties, then they wouldn't be glorious. And then they'd be ashamed of themselves as kshatriyas. So for Kshatriya to undergo difficulty is great. That's what he wants. But anyway, for a pure devotee, there's no real suffering. It only seems to be suffering. It's different. It's different. And the neophyte has to suffer because he's impure. But a pure devotee is not suffering. You may think he's suffering, but you're not seeing it right then. Yeah. Actually, a pure devotee never suffers, no matter what seems to be happening to him. Yasmin stito nadukena gurunapi vichalyate. Being situated in pure Krishna consciousness, a person is not disturbed even by the most painful situation. Cause of pain, but pain is not experienced.
Means you have to suffer due to their past activities?
No! A pure devotee has no karma. Whatever happens is simply Krishna's pleasure. They have no karma. They have no reactions to suffer. That is pure devotee. If there's karma, then he's not a pure devotee. A devotee who is not yet pure has some fraction of his previous karma. But a pure devotee, nothing left. No karma. No suffering because of past activities. Then he's not pure. He's maybe almost pure. But if he's still suffering the actions of past activities, he's not yet a pure devotee. That's not pandavas. You may read something in Mahabharata that looks like that, but that is just, you know, appearance of the pastime for pure devotees. Okay? Right. Okay, yeah, but there was a few others.
Yeah. I heard that in Namajrita Mahatma, there's a conversation between Nithyananda Prabhu and Srila Goswami. Nithyananda Prabhu explains inhabitants of Puri Dham. Some of them are actual inhabitants, some of them are just living there with their pious participatory. He differentiates between.
Okay.
So how do we identify
anyone? Yes, some people here are not real residents. Yeah. Who? How do you know who's who? That's the thing. We can't tell. So you have to be careful not to commit offense against anybody because you don't know who you're offending. You don't know if it's an eternal associate of Krishna, a Paramahamsa. You don't know what you're dealing with. You look at someone and, oh, this dirty beggar or this fat dillywalla, you know. But you don't know who you're dealing with. It might be a Paramahamsa. It might be an eternal associate of Krishna. So we have to be careful and not offend anybody because we can't judge. We can't tell one from the other. The real associates, the real residents, we can't tell. Anybody who's here, even coming from Delhi or from Baroda, for, you know, just for one day, you can't judge who they are. So be careful. If you can't judge, then you have to give respect to everybody, if you can't distinguish.
And also, the inhabitants of the Holy Dham, when they die, they go to the Krishna Holy Dham.
They're already with Krishna. They're already living in the Holy Dham, in Krishna's eternal Dham. So they'll stay with Krishna. They'll maybe in a different place. You know, they don't have to go to Krishna, they're already with him. You know, they don't have to wait to die. They're already connected with Krishna in his eternal abode. We don't see it. We think they're just, you know, silly people, you know, and not doing any sadhana. But we don't know the relationship with Krishna.
Continuing my question, does it mean that if a devotee stays somewhere else outside of the dham, in the grasp of that other company, he can be more free in his attitude or, like, you know, like we said, here we don't know.
You could say that you can get away with committing more aparadhas outside the Holy Dham. You can live a less healthy life. You can be sick all the time and think you're healthy living outside the Holy Dham. But do you want to do that? You know, yes, you have more freedom to commit aparadhas without as much punishment. Even sinful activities, you don't get a serious punishment outside the Dham. And you can live an unhealthy, unnatural lifestyle, and it's the same as everybody else, so it doesn't appear to be unhealthy. If you want to do that, you can. But it's not real life. It's not the standard of the real potential of human life to be living like that. I don't mean that you can't be pure devotee outside the Dham. You can also be perfectly Krishna conscious living anywhere. But there are special facilities to living in the Dham. We should live within Vrindavan in our hearts, even if we can't live there physically. And what's the use of living here physically, but in our hearts we don't like it? We don't, you know, we wish we were anywhere else. Then what's the use of being here then? Then that's also not consistent. The first thing is to live in Vrindavan within your heart. That's the most important thing. Yes, this is our process of purification, that we tolerate what is given to us by Krishna's arrangement. Tatte nukampam. Bhunjena eva atmakritam. You have to tolerate what is the reaction to your karma. But we have our limits of tolerance. So, and sometimes we tolerate, but with struggle. You know, we get upset and then we finally surrender with some struggle. So we can't tolerate everything perfectly. But we've got our quarter of things that we're not going to be able to avoid. You know, we shouldn't look for more suffering than we already have. You know, we shouldn't go out of our way to make things more difficult for ourselves. Things are difficult enough just living our lives under the conditions that we're put in. No matter what those conditions are, we have difficulties. Our appropriate renunciation or appropriate tolerance is to tolerate what we can't avoid. In the unavoidable, difficult conditions of our life, that's what we have to tolerate, and that's what we can trust Krishna that we will be able to tolerate. Not that we can live, you know, imitate perfect Paramahamsas and tolerate everything, but we all got what has been sent to us that we are expected to tolerate as individuals. That we will be given the strength to be able to overcome. As second class devotees. Madhyama bhaktis. Then you attain nishtha and you can start moving towards the first class platform. Okay. One last comment or question, and then I have actually something I need to discuss about the class schedules. Yes.
One last thing you said.
Yes.
Because you said that we have to tolerate what is given to us, but usually we are invited also to undergo some tapasya, as in Kartik.
Okay, we take vows and voluntarily take. Yes.
So can you say something about this topic also related to what you said before, that we have to tolerate what?
Well, two reasons to accept extra austerities, you know, to take a vow, do more than the minimum of austerity. The main reason is to increase your attraction to Krishna. And if it makes you less Krishna conscious, then it's backfiring. It's negative effect. The positive effect should be that it makes you more Krishna conscious, more attracted to Krishna, more able to focus your mind on Krishna. By detaching yourself by force of will from unnecessary sense gratification, by taking a vow. And it's also for purification, but we should be careful. If we take more austerity than we can tolerate, it will fail anyway. And if we do it for material purposes, it won't please Krishna. We do it just, and we become proud of it, and we try to cram our austerities down someone else's throat. You know, we've done it voluntarily and we want to see that everybody else does the same thing. That's not good. You know, that we look down at others who don't follow the same austerity that we've accepted voluntarily. So it can be misused. We have to be careful with these optional austerities and we don't misuse them. Okay, but it can be good. It can make, you know, the purpose is to make your Krishna consciousness increase. And to help you get free from the things that are obstructing advancement. For that purpose, good, but done carefully, under guidance of Guru. Like you go to a doctor before starting a heavy exercise program. So if you're going to do extra austerity exercises, you should consult with your Guru before doing it. Or your spiritual advisors. That you're not going to go, you know, get carried away and do something unprudent. Okay? Okay, now I just want to discuss. You're going to experience that the workload is going to get somewhat heavier because in the Bhagavatam overview class, the overview of each chapter, one at a time, is going to begin. And the students are going to be expected to read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. And we were discussing with Madan Mohan Prabhu to set up work study groups, maybe groups of three devotees each. And it may be that the arrangement will be that you don't have to read the whole thing, that the group of three will divide up the reading load. Each chapter will be treated in 2 or 3 days in the class. So I think the arrangement will be, although it isn't finalized yet, that in your study group of three, each group, the three people, will divide up a section, like one chapter, into three parts, so you don't have to read the whole chapter. Each person reads their assigned fraction of it, and then they get together and discuss it as a group. This, of course, has to be done in your so-called free time. You know, the work groups are going to be voluntary. You don't have to participate in them, but this is going to be a facility. And the work groups will be informal. Madan Mohan Prabhu will coordinate them, but you decide yourselves when you're going to sit down and meet and how you're going to conduct your business. We're not trying to micromanage your lives, that, you know, we're going to dictate what you do every minute of the day. But the one requirement of this program, if you want to participate in it, you know, for the whole 3 years, is that you attend all the scheduled programs. Now, what do you do the rest of the day, whether you do your homework or not, that's your business. If you want to goof off and do no homework, okay, you won't get full advantage. But we won't insist on that. That's your, you know, we expect you to manage your own life after lunch. But the scheduled programs are mandatory, including, I'm sorry, the yoga classes. Okay? The short, there's only 15 minutes of pranayama in the morning, half an hour in the early evening, and maybe we can change the time of it, but it's mandatory. Even if you have some other exercises you do, even if you have a bad back and you can't do all the exercises, come there. And we can make allowance, you can do your own exercise or something else, but everyone is obliged to come to those sessions also. Okay, and that's like a prerequisite for being, you know, we agreed to maintain you for 3 years without cost, but the prerequisite is attendance of the programs, at least the scheduled programs. So the rest of the day you can manage, you can do whatever you want. Okay, any comments about that?
In Madan Mohan, is he going to tell us which section we should read?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we have the schedule already made up. You mean for the work groups? He'll coordinate it. But then the work groups will manage themselves. He'll just give guidance, you know, some ideas what to do. Okay, so once he sets it up, from day to day, week to week, the work groups should decide themselves how they're going to operate and how they're going to divide up the workload.
Oh, he's not going to tell you, like...
No, he'll set it up. He'll organize it. And he'll be available for advice if anybody wants to consult. But, you know, each group should be able to organize, you know, to manage itself. And then you can choose. You can, you know, choose how you want to operate. If you want to, all three of you read all the text, you can do that. Or if you want to divide it up so each only has to read 1/3 of the text, you can do that.
So with the discussion time, Madan Mohan Prabhu thinks it will be shorter than... I mean, discussion between three of the devotees.
You mean when they meet and for how long?
No.
Yeah.
The discussion time of those between three devotees will be shorter than to read for yourself, the whole chapter?
Well, it's just less reading if you don't have to read the whole chapter in 2 days. If you only have to read one third of it and then sit down and talk. But you can decide, no, we think we'd rather just read it and maybe just have a short meeting together. Each group can decide that for themselves.
And because discussion also, it's not...
Takes time, yeah.
I mean, not in 5 minutes.
It's yeah. Well, it's meant to facilitate. So if you know whatever you know you find the most productive and least troublesome, do that. I mean, the groups can even disband themselves if they want. You know, we'd rather just go on and study by ourselves. You know, you don't. The groups are not mandatory.
So the idea was that one who read a particular section, he can already being read. He can just.
He can brief the others.
The points which
right.
are required, so that others don't have to read.
Yeah.
So, for example, some topic particular, and he already read, and everybody read, and then they get together, and he said, I found this, regarding this topic, this, you don't have to read, I already read. So, this is. So
theoretically, that could take less time. Yeah, you have to see in practice, you know, for each group what you do. Okay. I mean, we'll, you know, Madhava will organize the groups, and the groups can do what they want, include disband themselves if they want. Yes?
This Bhagavatam overview course. Last
3 years. Because it'll take 3 years. We got it paced out to cover the 12 cantos in 3 years. The grammar course stops because you should be done with the grammar. You will have assimilated the grammar after 2 years. And then we'll go on to some other things to replace it in the third year.
It's not yet decided.
Well, because there's several options. We can't do all of them. We have to pick and choose.
And workshop?
The that will go on for the 2 years that the grammar course goes on. That will also stop. So there'll be other things. The third year course hasn't been fixed yet. Okay, so we can stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.